Chapter 6. On Wednesday, May 11th, they were back in the house. They put Reagan to bed, installed a lock on the shutters, and as they were stripping all the mirrors from her bedroom and bathroom, Chris recollected the final summary of the Barringer Clinic psychiatrist. "Fewer and fewer lucid moments, Ms. McNeil. And now there's a total blacking out of her consciousness during the fits, I'm afraid. Now that's new and would seem to eliminate genuine hysteria. In the meantime, a symptom or two in the area of what we call parapsychic phenomena have..." Dr. Klein came by and Chris attended with Sharon as he drilled them in proper procedures for administering sustenance feedings to Reagan during her periods of coma. He inserted the nasogastric tubing. "First," he said. Chris forced herself to watch, and yet still not see her daughter's face, to grip at the words that the doctor was saying and push away the others that she'd heard at the clinic. "Now, you stated no religion here, Ms. McNeil. Is that right? No religious education at all?" "Oh, maybe just God, you know, general." "Why?" "Well, for one thing, the content of much of her raving, when it isn't that gibberish she's been spouting, well, it's religiously oriented. Now, where do you think she might have gotten that?" "Well, first give me a for instance." "Okay, then. Jesus and Mary, 69, for example." Klein had guided the tubing into Reagan's stomach. "First, you check to see if fluid's gotten into her lungs," he instructed, pinching on the tube in order to clamp off the flow of sustagen. "It's a syndrome of a type of disorder, Ms. McNeil, that you rarely ever see anymore, except among primitive cultures. We call it somnambuliform possession. Now, quite frankly, we don't know much about it, except that it starts with some conflict or guilt that eventually leads to the patient's delusion that his body's been invaded by an alien intelligence, or a spirit, if you will. And times gone by, when belief in the devil was fairly strong, the possessing entity was usually a demon. In relatively modern cases, though, it's mostly the spirit of someone dead, very often someone the patient has known or seen, and is able unconsciously to mimic as to the voice and the mannerisms, even the features of the face at rare times. After a gloomy Dr. Klein had left the house, Chris telephoned her agent in Beverly Hills and announced to him lifelessly that she definitely would not be directing Hope. Then she called Mrs. Perrin. She was out. Chris hung up the phone with a mounting dread. Who was it who could help her? She desperately wondered. Was there anyone? Anything? What? Cases where it's spirits of the dead are easier to deal with. You don't find the rages in most of those cases, or the hyperactivity and the motor excitement. However, in the other main type of somnambuliform possession, the new personality is always malevolent, always hostile toward the first. Its primary aim, in fact, is to damage and sometimes even kill it. A set of restraining straps had been delivered to the Prospect Street house, and Chris stood watching, wan and spent, while Carl affixed them, first to Reagan's bed, and then to her wrists. As Chris moved the pillow in an effort to center it under Reagan's head, the Swiss straightened up and looked pityingly at the child's ravaged face. "She is going to be well?" Chris didn't answer. As Carl was speaking, she had slipped out an object from under Reagan's pillow and was holding it up to her mystified gaze. Then her glance flicked to Carl as she snapped at him sternly. Call whom to help with this crucifix here? The syndrome is only a manifestation of some conflict, of some guilt. So we try to get at it, find out what it is. Well, the best procedure in a case like this is hypnotherapy. However, we can't seem to put her under. So then we took a shot at narcosynthesis. But it looks like another dead end. Fine. So what's next? Mostly time. We'll just have to keep trying and hoping there's a change. In the meantime, she is going to have to be hospitalized. Chris found Sharon in the kitchen, setting up her typewriter on the table. She had just brought it up from the basement playroom. Willie sliced carrots in the sink for a stew. With a current of tension and strain in her voice, Chris asked, "Was it you who put the crucifix under her pillow, Cher?" Sharon looked befuddled. "What do you mean, Chris? You didn't?" "Chris, I don't even know what you're talking about. Look, I told you before, Chris. I told you on the plane. All I've ever said about religion to rags is stuff like God made the world and maybe things about..." "Fine, Sharon, fine. I believe you, but..." "Me, I don't put it," growled Willie defensively, interrupting. "God damn it, somebody put it there!" Chris wheeled on Carl, who had just entered the kitchen and opened the refrigerator door. "Carl!" she called out to him sharply. "Yes, madam," Carl answered her calmly without turning around. He was folding ice cubes into a face towel. "Well, I'm asking you one more time," Chris said grittily, her voice cracking and at the edge of shrillness. "Did you put that freaking crucifix under Reagan's pillow?" "No, madam, not me. I don't do it," Carl answered as he plopped another ice cube into the towel.
"That fucking cross didn't just walk up there, goddammit!" Chris shrieked as she spun around to Willie and Sharon. "Now which one of you is lying to me?"
Carl stopped what he was doing and turned to study Chris. Her sudden rage had stunned the room, and now abruptly she slumped down into a chair, convulsively sobbing into trembling hands. "Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm doing. Oh, my God, I don't know." While Willie and Carl stood silently watching, Sharon came up behind Chris and started kneading her neck and shoulders with comforting hands. "Hey, okay. Okay, Chris. It's okay." Chris wiped at her face with the back of a sleeve. "Yeah. Yeah, I guess whoever did it..." She found a handkerchief in a pocket and blew her nose, and then continued. "Whoever did it was only trying to help, I guess." "Look, I'm telling you again, and you better believe it, all of you doctors, I am not about to put her into an asylum." "Ma'am, it isn't..."
"I don't care what the hell you call it. No way, I am not letting her out of my sight."
"Ma'am, I am all so sorry. We all are." "Yes, sure. 88 doctors, Jesus Christ, with all of it." Chris tore the cellophane off a blue packet of Galois Blondes, an imported French cigarette, took a few deep puffs, and then tamped it out rapidly in an ashtray and went upstairs to look in on Reagan. When she opened the door and the gloom of the bedroom, she made out a male figure by Reagan's bedside, sitting in a straight-backed wooden chair, his arm outstretched and his hand over Reagan's brow. Chris moved closer. It was Carl. When Chris reached the bedside, he neither looked up at her, nor did he speak, but kept his gaze intently on the child's face. There was something in the hand on Reagan's brow. What was it? Then she saw it was an improvised ice pack. Surprised and touched, Chris appraised the stolid Swiss with a look of fondness that she had long ago misplaced. But when he neither moved nor acknowledged her presence, she turned away and quietly left the room. She went down to the kitchen, sat in the breakfast nook, drank coffee, and stared off distantly in thought until, on a sudden impulse, she stood up and walked briskly toward the cherrywood-paneled study. Once again, Chris's thoughts had drifted back to the words of the Barringer Clinic psychiatrist. Possession is loosely related to hysteria, insofar as the origin of the syndrome is almost always auto-suggested. Your daughter might have known about possession, believed in possession, and possibly known about some of its symptoms, so that now her unconscious is producing the syndrome. You following me, ma'am? Now, if that can be firmly established, and you still won't agree to hospitalization, you might just want to take a stab at something that I'm going to suggest. It has only an outside chance of a cure, I think, but still, it's a chance. Well, for God's sake, name it. What is it? Have you ever heard of exorcism, Mrs. McNeil? Chris was unfamiliar with the books in the study. They were part of the furnishings that came with the house. And now she was carefully scanning the titles. It's a stylized ritual pretty much out of date, in which rabbis and priests tried to drive out an evil spirit, well, so-called. It's only the Catholics who haven't discarded it yet, but they keep it pretty much in the closet as a sort of an embarrassment, I think. But to someone who really thinks he's possessed, I'd have to say that the ritual's pretty impressive. And it used to work, in fact, although not for the reason that they thought. No, of course not. It was purely the force of suggestion. The victim's belief in possession helped cause it. And in just the same way, his belief in the power of the exorcism can make it disappear. It's... Oh, I see you're frowning. Well, of course, I know it sounds pretty far-fetched. Well, then let me tell you something similar that we know to be a fact. It has to do with Australian Aborigines. They're convinced that if some wizard thinks a death ray at them from a distance, why, they're definitely going to die. And you know what? They do. They just lie down and slowly die. And the only thing that saves them most times is a similar form of suggestion, a counteracting ray by another wizard. Are you telling me to take my daughter to a witch doctor? As a last-ditch desperate measure? Well, yes. Yes? I suppose that I'm saying exactly that. Take her to a Catholic priest. That's a rather bizarre little piece of advice, I know, and honestly, maybe even a little bit dangerous, unless we can definitely ascertain whether or not your daughter knew anything at all about possession, and particularly exorcism, before any of her symptoms came on. Do you think she might have read it somewhere? No. Seen a movie about it, something on the radio, TV? No. Read the Gospels, maybe? The New Testament? No, she hasn't. Why are you asking? There are quite a few accounts of possession in them and of exorcisms by Christ. The descriptions of the symptoms, in fact, are the same as in possession today. So, look, I'm sorry, it's just no good, okay? Just forget it. That's all I need is to have a father here. I called in a... Chris's fingertips moved from book to book, searching, but so far finding nothing until... Hey, hold it. Her eyes darted quickly back to a title on the bottom shelf. It was the book about witchcraft that Mary Jo Perrin had sent to her. Chris plucked it out and turned quickly to the table of contents, running her thumbnail slowly down the list until, abruptly, she stopped and thought, there it is. Soft thrills of surmise rippled through her. Were the doctors at Barringer right after all? Was this it? Had Reagan plucked her disorder and her symptoms through auto-suggestion from the pages of this book? The title of a chapter was States of Possession. Chris walked to the kitchen where Sharon was seated, reading her shorthand from a propped-up notepad while typing a letter. Chris held up the book. Have you ever read this, Cher? Still typing, Sharon asked, read what? Look at me, this book about witchcraft. Sharon stopped typing, turned a glance to Chris and the book, and said, No, Chris, I haven't. She turned back to her work. You've never seen it, Sharon? You never put it on a bookshelf in the study? No. Where's Willie, Cher? At the market. Chris nodded and stood silently pondering, then went back upstairs to Reagan's bedroom, where Carl still kept vigil at her daughter's side. Carl.
Yes, madam.
Chris held up the book. By any chance, did you find this lying around and then put it with the rest of the books in the study? The houseman turned to Chris, expressionless, shifted his gaze to the book and then back to her.
No, madam, he said. Not me.
Then he turned his gaze back to Reagan. Okay, then, Chris thought. Maybe Willie. Chris returned to the kitchen, sat down at the table, and, opening the book to the chapter on possession, she began to search for anything relevant, anything that doctors at Barringer Clinic thought might have given rise to Reagan's symptoms. And found it. Immediately derivative of the prevalent belief in demons was the phenomenon known as possession, a state in which many individuals believed that their physical and mental functions had been invaded and were being controlled by either a demon, most common in the period under discussion, or the spirit of someone dead. There is no period of history or quarter of the globe where this phenomenon has not been reported, and in fairly constant terms, and yet it is still to be adequately explained. Since Traugott Oesterreich's definitive study, first published in 1921, very little has been added to the body of knowledge, the advances of psychiatry notwithstanding. Chris frowned. Not fully explained? She'd had a different impression from the doctors at Barringer. She continued to read. What is known is the following, that various people at various times have undergone massive transformations so complete that those around them feel they are dealing with another person. Not only the voice, the mannerisms, facial expressions, and characteristic movements are sometimes altered, but the subject himself now thinks of himself as totally distinct from the original person and as having a name, whether human or demonic, and a separate history of its own. In the Malay archipelago, where possession even now is an everyday common occurrence, the possessing spirit of someone dead often causes the possessed to mimic its gestures, voice, and mannerisms so strikingly that relatives of the deceased will burst into tears. But aside from so-called quasi-possession, those cases are ultimately reduced to fraud, paranoia, and hysteria. The problem has always lain with interpreting the phenomena, the oldest interpretation being the spiritist, an impression that is likely to be strengthened by the fact that the intruding personality may have accomplishments quite foreign to the first. In the demoniacal form of possession, for example, the demon may speak in languages unknown to the first personality. There, Chris thought. Reagan's gibberish. An attempt at a language? Chris read on quickly. Or manifest parapsychic phenomena, such as telekinesis, for example, the movement of objects without application of material force. The rappings, thought Chris. The flingings up and down on the bed. In cases of possession by the dead, there are manifestations such as Oesterreich's account of a monk who, abruptly, while possessed, became a gifted and brilliant dancer, although he had never, before his possession, had occasion to dance so much as a step. So impressive at times are these manifestations that Jung's psychiatrist, after studying a case at first hand, could offer only partial explanation for what he was certain could not have been fraud. Chris frowned. The tone of this was worrisome. And William James, she read on, the greatest psychologist that America has ever produced, resorted to positing the plausibility of the spiritualist interpretation of the phenomenon after closely studying the so-called Watsika wonder, a teenage girl in Watsika, Illinois, who became indistinguishable in personality from a girl named Mary Roth, who had died in a state insane asylum 12 years prior to the possession. Riveted, Chris did not hear the doorbell chime, did not hear Sharon stop typing and go to the door. The demoniacal form of possession is usually thought to have its origin in early Christianity. Yet in fact, both possession and exorcism predate the time of Christ. The ancient Egyptians, as well as the earlier civilizations of the Tigris and the Euphrates, believed that physical and spiritual disorders were caused by invasion of the body by demons. The following, for example, is the formula for exorcism against maladies of children in ancient Egypt. Go hence, thou who comest in darkness, whose nose is turned backwards, whose face is upside down. Hast thou come to kiss this child? I will not let thee. Chris? Sure, I'm busy. Chris says a homicide detective wants to see you. Oh, Christ, Sharon, tell... Abruptly, Chris stopped, then looked up and said, Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure, Sharon. Tell him to come in. Let him in. Sharon left, and Chris stared at the pages of the book, unseeing, gripped by some formless yet gathering premonition of dread. Sound of a door being closed. Sound of walking this way. A sense of waiting. Waiting. Waiting for what? Like the vivid dream one can never remember, Chris felt an expectancy that seemed known and yet undefined. His hat brim crumpled in his hands. He came in with Sharon, wheezing and listing and deferential. Oh, I am really so sorry, Kinderman said as he approached. Yes, you're busy, I can see that, I'm a bother. So how's the world? Chris asked him. Oh, very bad. And how's your daughter? No change. Oh, I'm so sorry. Breathing adenoidally, Kinderman was standing by the table now, his drooping beagle eyes moist with concern. Look, I wouldn't even bother. I mean your daughter. It's a worry. God knows when my little girl Julie was down with the... What now? What was it? I can't remember it. Why don't you sit down? Chris cut in. Oh yes, thank you very much. The detective exhaled gratefully while settling his bulk in a chair across from Sharon, who, seemingly oblivious, continued to type. So I'm sorry, Lieutenant, you were saying? Well, my daughter, she... Ah, no, never mind. I get started, I'll be telling you my whole life story. You could maybe make a film of it. No, really. It's incredible. If you only knew half the crazy things that used to happen in my family, you... No, never mind. All right, one. I'll tell one. like my mother... Every Friday, she would make us gefilte fish, all right? Only all week long, the whole week. No one gets to take a bath on account of my mother has the carp in the bathtub. It's swimming back and forth, because my mother said this cleaned out the poison in its system. I mean, really, who knew? Who knew the carp the whole time of thinking these horrible and evil, vindictive thoughts? Oh, well enough. I'm really sorry. Only now and then a laugh, you know, just to keep us from crying. Chris studied him, waiting.
Are you reading?
The detective was looking down at the book on witchcraft.
For a film?
No, just passing the time.
Is it good?
I don't know. I just started it.
Witchcraft, Kinderman murmured,
his head angled to the side as he read the book's title at the top of a page. So, K-Dow, Lieutenant, what's doing? Chris asked.
Ah, yes, I'm sorry. You're busy. I'll finish. Now, as I said, I wouldn't bother you except...
Except what? Looking suddenly grave, the detective clasped his hands together on the polished pine tabletop. Well, it seems that Burke...
Damn it!
Snapped Sharon irritably, as she ripped out a letter from the platen of the typewriter, crumpled it up in her hands, and then errantly tossed it into a waste paper basket close to Kinderman's feet. He and Chris had turned their heads to stare at her, and when the secretary saw them, she said, Oh, I'm so sorry. God, I didn't even know you were there.
You're Miss Fenster? Asked Kinderman.
Spencer, Sharon corrected him, as she slid her chair back and got up to retrieve the balled-up letter from the floor with a murmured, I never said I was Julius Irving.
Never mind, the detective told her, as reaching to the floor near his foot, he picked up the crumpled page.
Oh, thanks, Sharon stopped and went back to her chair.
Excuse me, you're the secretary? Kinderman asked her.
Oh, Sharon, this is... Chris turned to Kinderman.
Sorry, she said to him. Your name again?
Kinderman. William F. Kinderman. This is Sharon, Sharon Spencer. With a courtly tilt and nod of the head, the detective told Sharon,
It's a pleasure.
Sharon was now bent forward, eyeing him curiously, her chin resting on folded arms atop the typewriter.
And perhaps you can help me. The detective added.
Her arms still folded, Sharon sat up and said,
Me?
Yes, maybe.
On the night of Mr. Denning's demise, you went out to a drugstore and you left him alone in the house, am I correct?
Well, not exactly. Reagan was here. That's my daughter, Chris clarified.
Spelling?
R-E-G-A-N, Chris told him.
Lovely name, said Kim.
Thank you. The detective turned back to Sharon.
Now, Dennings had come here that night to see Mrs. McNeil.
Yes, that's right.
He expected her shortly?
Well, yeah, I told him I expected her back pretty soon.
Good, very good. And you left at what time? You remember?
Let's see, I was watching the news, so I guess...
Oh, no, wait. Yeah, that's right. I remember being bothered because the pharmacist said the delivery boy had gone home, and I said, oh, come on now, or something about it only being about 6:30.
Then Burke came along just 10, maybe 20 minutes after that, at the most.
So a median, concluded the detective, would have put him here at 6:45, not so?
And so what's this all about? Chris asked him.
The nebulous tension she'd been feeling had mounted. Well, it raises a question, Mrs. McNeil. To arrive at the house at, say, 6:45 and leave only 20 minutes later? Chris shrugged.
Oh, well, that was Burke, she said. Just like him.
Was it also like him, Kinderman asked, to frequent the bars down on M Street?
Bar? No, not at all.
Oh, no, not that I know of. No, I thought not. I made a little check. And so he wouldn't have had a reason to be at the top of those steps beside your house after leaving here that night. And was it also not his custom to travel by taxi? Wouldn't call a cab from your house when he left?
Well, yeah, he would.
At least he always did. Then one wonders, not so, why or how he came to be there that night. And one wonders why taxicab companies
do not show a record of calls from this house on that night, except for the one that picked up your Miss Spencer here at precisely 6:47. Her voice drained of color. Chris said softly, I don't know.
No, I doubted that you would, the detective told her.
In the meantime, the matter has now grown somewhat serious. Chris was breathing shallowly. In what way?
The report of the pathologist, Kinderman recounted, seems to show that the chance that Dennings died accidentally is still very possible. However, are you saying he was murdered?
Well, it seems that the position... Kinderman hesitated.
I'm sorry, he said. This will be painful.
Go ahead.
The position of Denning's head and the certain shearing of the muscles of the neck would...
Shutting her eyes, Chris winced and said, oh, God.
Yes, as I said, it's very painful. I'm so sorry, really. But you see, this condition, I think we can skip the details, perhaps.
It never could happen unless Mr. Dennings had fallen some distance before he hit the steps. For example, maybe 20-30 feet before he went rolling down to the bottom. So a clear possibility, plainly speaking, is that maybe...
Kinderman turned to Sharon. Arms folded across her chest, she had been listening, mesmerized, wide-eyed.
Well, now first let me ask you something, Miss Spencer. When you left, he was where, Mr. Dennings? With the child?
No, he was down here in the study, fixing a drink.
Ah, might your daughter remember,
he turned to Chris, if perhaps Mr. Dennings was in her room that night?
Why do you ask?
Might your daughter remember?
How could she? Like I told you, she was heavily sedated and...
Yes, yes, you did tell me. That's true, I recall it. But perhaps she awakened.
Well, she didn't, Chris told him.
She was also sedated when last we spoke?
Yes, she was.
I thought I saw her at her window that day.
Well, you're mistaken.
Could be.
Yes,
perhaps so. I'm just not sure.
Listen, why are you asking me all this?
Well, a clear possibility, as I was saying, is maybe the deceased was so drunk that he stumbled and fell from the window in your daughter's bedroom.
Not so?
No way. In the first place, that window was always closed, and besides, Burke was always drunk, but he never got sloppy.
Burke used to direct when he was drunk. Now, how could he stumble and fall out a window?
Or you may be expecting someone else here that night.
Someone else?
No, I wasn't.
Have you friends who drop by without calling?
Only Burke. The detective lowered his head and shook it.
So strange, he breathed out wearily. Baffling.
Then he lifted his glance to Chris.
The deceased comes to visit. Stays only 20 minutes without even seeing you, and leaves all alone here, a very sick girl? And speaking plainly, as you yourself would say, it's not likely he would fall from a window. Besides, a fall wouldn't do to his neck, what we found, except maybe a chance in 100, in 1,000.
He motioned with his head at the witchcraft book.
Read in that book about ritual murder?
Her chill prescience mounting.
Chris quietly said, no.
Well, maybe not in that book.
However, forgive me, I mention this only so maybe you'll think just a little bit harder. Poor Mr. Dennings was discovered with his head wrenched around in the style of ritual murder by so-called demons, Mrs. McNeil.
Chris's complexion visibly paled.
Some lunatic killed Mr. Dennings and...
Kinderman halted.
Something wrong? He asked. He had noticed the tension in her eyes, her sudden pallor. No, 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 nothing. Nothing's wrong. Go ahead. I'm obliged. Now, at first, I never told you to spare you the hurt. And besides, it could technically still be an accident. But me, I don't think so. My hunch, my opinion, I believe he was killed by a powerful man, point one. And the fracturing of his skull, point two, plus the various things I have mentioned would make it very probable. Probable, not certain. Your director was killed and then afterward pushed from your daughter's window. But no one was here except your daughter. So then how could this be? Well, it could be one way. If someone came calling between the time Miss Spencer left and the time you returned, not so? Now I ask you again, please. Who might have come? Chris lowered her head. Oh, Judas Priest, just a second. Yes, I'm sorry, it's painful. And perhaps I'm all wrong, but you'll think now. Who might have come, please? Head still lowered. Chris frowned and thought for a time, then looked up. No. No, I'm sorry. There's just no one I can think of. Kinderman turned his glance to Sharon. Maybe you then, Miss Spencer? Someone comes here to see you? Oh, no, 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 no one. Does the horseman know where you work? Chris asked her. Kinderman's eyebrows rose. The horseman? Sharon's boyfriend, Chris explained. Sharon shook her head. Oh, he's never come here, she said. Besides, he was in Boston that night at some convention. Oh, he's a salesman, asked Kinderman. No, he's a lawyer. Ah. The detective turned back to Chris. The servants, they have visitors? No, no, never. Not ever at all. You expected a package that day, some delivery? Why? Mr. Dennings was, not to speak ill of the dead. But as you said, in his cups, he was somewhat, well, let's call it irascible, and capable, doubtless, of provoking an argument or an anger, and in this case, maybe even a rage from perhaps some delivery person who'd come by with a package. So, were you expecting something? Dry cleaning, maybe, groceries, liquor, a package? I wouldn't know. Carl handles all of that. Ah, right, of course. If you want to ask him, go ahead. The detective sighed morosely. Leaning back from the table, he stuffed his hands into the pockets of his coat as he cast a glum look at the witchcraft book. Never mind, never mind. It's remote. You've got a daughter very sick and, well, enough now. He made a gesture of dismissal. That's it. End of meeting. He stood up. Thank you for your time, he said to Chris, and then to Sharon. Very nice to have met you, Miss Spencer. Same here, Sharon answered remotely. She was staring into space. Baffling, said Kinderman with a head shake. So strange. So very strange. He was focused on some inner thought. Then he looked up at Chris as she rose from her chair. Well, I'm sorry I bothered you for nothing, he said. Here, I'll walk you to the door, Chris told him. Both her expression and her voice were subdued. Oh, no, please don't bother. No, it's no bother at all. If you insist. Oh, incidentally, the detective said, as he and Chris were moving out of the kitchen. Just a chance in a million, I know, but your daughter. You could ask her if she possibly saw Mr. Dennings in her room that night. Look, he wouldn't have had a reason to be up there in the first place. Yes, I know that, I realize that's true. But if certain British doctors had never asked, what's this fungus, we wouldn't today have penicillin. Am I right? Please ask. You'll ask? Well, when she's well enough, yeah, I'll ask. Couldn't hurt. They had arrived at the home's front door. In the meantime, the detective continued. But he faltered, and touching two fingertips to his lips, he said gravely,
"Look, I hate to be asking you this. Please forgive me."
Expecting some new shock, Chris tensed and felt that prescience tingling again in her bloodstream. She said, "What?"
"For my daughter.
You could maybe give an autograph." The detective's cheeks had reddened. After a moment of surprise, Chris almost laughed with relief at herself and at despair in the human condition.
"Of course. Where's the pen?"
"Right here," responded Kinderman instantly, whipping out a pen from the pocket of his coat, while his other hand dipped into a pocket of his jacket and slipped out a calling card. He handed them to Chris. Oh, she would love it. "What's her name?" Chris asked, pressing the card against the door as she held the pen poised to write. A weighty hesitation followed, as from behind her, she heard only wheezing. She glanced around, and in Kinderman's eyes and reddening face, she saw the tension of some massive inner struggle.
"I lied," he said finally, his eyes at once desperate and defiant. "The autograph's for me. Write to William, William F. Kinderman. It's spelled on the back."
Chris eyed him with a wan and unexpected affection, checked the spelling of his name, and wrote, "William F. Kinderman, I love you. Chris McNeil." And then gave him the card, which he tucked into his pocket without reading the inscription.
"You're a very nice lady," he said to Chris sheepishly.
"Thanks. You're a very nice man." He seemed to blush harder.
No, I'm not. I'm a bother."
He was opening the door.
"Look, never mind what I said here today.
All right, forget it.
Keep your mind on your daughter. Your daughter."
Chris nodded, her despondency returning as Kinderman stepped out onto a wide and low, black iron-gated stoop. He turned around and, in the daylight, was more conscious of the dark sacks beneath the movie star's eyes. He donned his hat.
"But you'll ask her," he reminded.
"I will," she said. "I promise."
"Well then, goodbye, and take care."
"You too." Chris shut the door and leaned back against it, closing her eyes, then almost instantly opened them again as she heard the chiming of the doorbell. She turned and opened the door, revealing Kinderman. He grimaced in apology.
"I'm a nuisance. I am so sorry. I forgot my pen."
Chris looked down and saw the pen still in her hand. She smiled faintly and handed it to the detective.
And another thing," he said. Yes, it's pointless. I know that. I'm sorry. I won't sleep tonight thinking maybe there's a lunatic loose or a doper if every little point I don't cover. Do you think I could..." No, it's dumb. It's a..."
"Yes. Yes, forgive me, but I think I really should. Could I maybe have a word with Mr. Engstrom, do you think? It's the deliveries, the question of deliveries." Chris opened the door wider. "Yeah, sure, come on in. You can talk to him in the study."
"Oh, no, you're busy. No, you're very kind, but enough already. I can talk to him here. This is fine. Here, fine."
He'd leaned back and was resting on the stoop's iron railing.
"If you insist," Chris told him, smiling faintly.
"I think he's upstairs with Reagan. I'll send him right down."
"I'm obliged."
Chris closed the door, and not long after, Carl opened it. He stepped down to the stoop with his hand on the doorknob, holding the door ajar.
Standing tall and erect,
he looked directly at Kinderman with eyes that were clear and cool.
"Yes?"
he asked without expression.
"You have the right to remain silent," Kinderman greeted him, his eyes now steely and locked on Carl's.
If you give up the right to remain silent, he intoned rapidly in a flat and deadly cadence, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to speak with an attorney and to have the attorney present during questioning. If you so desire and cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed for you without charge prior to questioning. Do you understand each of these rights I've explained to you? Birds twittered softly in the branches of the alder tree beside the house as the traffic sounds of M Street came up to them softly, like the humming of bees in a meadow far away. Carl's gaze never wavered as he answered, "Yes." "Do you wish to give up the right to remain silent?" "Yes." "Do you wish to give up the right to speak to an attorney and have him present during questioning?" "Did you previously state that on April 28th, the night of the death of the British director Burke Dennings, you attended a film that was showing at the Fine Arts Theater?" "I did." "And at what time did you enter the theater?" "I do not remember." "You stated previously you attended the 6 o'clock showing. Does that help you to remember?" "Yes, 6 o'clock show. I am remembering." "And you saw the picture, I mean, the film, from the beginning?" "I did." "And you left at the film's conclusion?" "I did." "Not before?" No, I see entire film." "And leaving the theater, you boarded the DC Transit bus in front of the theater, debarking at M Street and Wisconsin Avenue at approximately 9:20 p.m.? "Yes." "And walked home?" "I walk home." "And were back in this residence at approximately 9:30 p.m.? "I am back here exactly 9:30, Carl answered. "You're sure?" "Yes, I look at my watch. I am positive." "And you saw the whole film to the very end?" "Yes, I said that." "Your answers are being electronically recorded, Mr. Engstrom. Therefore, I want you to be absolutely positive." "I am." "You're aware of the altercation between an usher and a drunken patron that happened in the last 5 minutes of the film?" "Yes, I remember." "Can you tell me the cause of it?"
The man, he was drunk and making disturbance."
"And what did they do with him finally?"
"Out. They throw him out."
"There was no such disturbance." "And you're also aware that during the course of the 6 o'clock showing, a technical breakdown lasting approximately 15 minutes caused an interruption in the showing of the film?"
No, I am not."
"You recall that the audience booed?"
"No, nothing. No breakdown."
"You're sure?"
"Yes, there was nothing."
"There was, as reflected in the log of the projectionist, showing that the film ended not at 8:40 that night, but at approximately 8:55, which would mean that the earliest bus from the theater would put you at M Street in Wisconsin not at 9:20, but 9:45, and that, therefore, the earliest you could be at the house was approximately 5 before 10, not 9:30, as testified also by Mrs. McNeil. Would you care now to comment on this puzzling discrepancy?"
Not for a moment had Carl lost his poise, and he held it even now as he calmly answered, "No, I would not." The detective stared at him mutely, and then he sighed and looked down as he turned off the monitor control that was tucked in the lining of his coat. He held his gaze down for a moment, then looked back up at Carl.
"Mr. Engstrom," he began, in a tone that was weary with understanding, "a serious crime may have been committed. You are under suspicion. Mr. Dennings abused you. I have learned that from other sources. And apparently, you've now lied about your whereabouts at the time of his death. Now, it sometimes happens. We're human, huh? Why not? That a man who is married is sometimes someplace where he says that he is not. You will notice I arranged we are talking in private, away from the others, away from your wife. I'm not now recording this. It's off. You can trust me. If it happens you were out with a woman, not your wife, on that night, you can tell me
I'll have it checked out. You'll be out of this trouble. And your wife, she won't know. Now then, tell me. Where were you at the time Dennings died? Something flickered in the depths of Carl's eyes, but then died as he insisted through narrowed lips. At movies. The detective eyed him steadily, unmoving, with no sound but his wheezing as the seconds ticked by. Then, "You are going to arrest me?" Carl asked in a voice that now quavered. The detective made no answer, but continued to eye him, unblinking. And when Carl seemed again about to speak, the detective abruptly pushed away from the railing, moving toward his parked squad car and the driver, with his hands in his pockets, as he walked on hurriedly, viewing his surroundings to the left and to the right, like an interested visitor to the city. From the stoop, Carl watched, his features stolid and impassive, as Kinderman opened the door of the squad car, reached inside to a box of Kleenex affixed to the dashboard, extracted a tissue, and blew his nose while staring idly across the river, as if considering whether to have lunch at the Marriott Hot Shop. Then he entered the squad car without a glance back. As the car pulled away and rounded the corner of 35th Street, Carl looked at the hand that was not on the doorknob. It was trembling. When she heard the sound of the front door closing, Chris was brooding at the bar in the study as she poured herself a vodka over ice. Footsteps. Carl going up the stairs. Chris picked up her glass, took a sip, and then slowly moved back toward the kitchen with absent eyes, while stirring her drink with an index finger. Something was horribly wrong, like light leaking under a door into a darkened hallway somewhere out of time. The glow of coming dread had seeped further and further into her consciousness. What lay behind the door? She feared to open it and look. She entered the kitchen, sat at the table, sipped at her drink, and broodingly remembered. "I believe he was killed by a powerful man." She dropped her glance to the book on witchcraft. Something about it or in it. What? And now footsteps tripping lightly downstairs. Sharon returning from Reagan's bedroom. Entering. Sitting at the table and cranking fresh stationery into the IBM typewriter's roller. "Pretty creepy," she murmured, with her fingertips lightly resting on the keyboard and her eyes on her propped steno notes to the side. Staring into space, Chris sipped absently at her drink, then set it down and returned her gaze to the cover of the book. An uneasiness hung in the room. Her eyes still on her notes, Sharon probed at the silence in a strained low voice. "You know, got an awful lot of hippie joints down around M Street in Wisconsin. A lot of potheads and occultists and stuff. Police call them hellhounds. I wonder if Burke might..." "Oh, for shit's sake, Cher!" Chris suddenly erupted. "Just forget about it, would you? I've got all I can think about with rags. Do you mind?" There was a pause. And then Sharon started typing at a furious tempo, while Chris propped her elbows on the tabletop and buried her face in her hands. Abruptly, Sharon pushed her chair back with the sound of wood scraping on wood, bolted up and strode out of the kitchen. "Chris, I'm going for a walk," she said icily. "Good. Stay the hell away from M Street," Chris shot back into her hands. "I will. And N." Chris heard the front door being opened, then closed. And sighing, she lowered her hands and looked up, felt a pang of regret. The emotional flurry had siphoned off tension, but not all of it. Although fainter At the edge of her consciousness, there remained that ominous glow.
Shut it out, Chris.
Chris took a deep breath and tried to focus on the book. She found her place and, grown impatient, started hastily flipping through its pages, skimming and searching for specific descriptions that would match Reagan's symptoms. Demonic possession syndrome, she read. Case of an 8-year-old girl. Abnormal. 4 strong men to restrain her from. Turning the page, Chris froze. Then sounds. Willie entering the kitchen with groceries. Willie? Chris called out to her tonelessly, her eyes riveted to the book.
Yes, madam, I am here, Willie answered.
She was setting down bags full of groceries on a white-tiled counter. Dull-eyed and expressionless, her voice flat, and with her slightly trembling fingers holding her place. Chris held up the partly closed witchcraft book, asking, Willie, was it you put this book in the study? Willie came a few steps closer, squinted at the book's cover, briefly nodded, and as she turned and started back toward the groceries, answered,
Yes, Mrs. Yes, yes, I put it.
Willie, where did you find it?
Up in bedroom, Willie answered, as she started slipping groceries out of the bags and onto the kitchen counter.
Chris stared fixedly at the pages of the book, now back on the table and open to her place.
Which bedroom, Willie?
Miss Reagan bedroom, missus. I find it under bed when I am cleaning.
Her voice numb, her eyes wide and fixedly staring. Chris looked up and said, When did you find it?
After all, go to hospital, madam, when I vacuum in Reagan bedroom.
Willie, are you absolutely sure?
Yes, I am sure.
Chris looked down at the pages of the book, and for a time she did not move, did not blink, did not breathe, as the headlong image of an open window in Reagan's bedroom on the night of Denning's accident rushed at her memory with its talons extended like a bird of prey that knew her name. As she recognized the sight that was so numbingly familiar, as she stared at the right-hand page of the open book where a narrow strip had been shaved from the length of its edge. Chris jerked up her head. Some commotion in Reagan's bedroom. Rappings, rapid and loud, and with a nightmarish resonance that was massive and yet somehow muffled, like a sledgehammer pounding at a limestone wall deep within some ancient tomb. Reagan screaming in anguish, in terror, imploring. Carl shouting angrily, fearfully, at Reagan. Chris bolted from the kitchen.
God almighty, what's happening? What?
Frenzied, Chris ran up the staircase, raced to the second floor, then toward Reagan's bedroom, when she heard a blow, someone reeling, someone crashing to the floor, and her daughter cried,
No! Oh, no, don't! Oh, no, please!
And Carl bellowing, No, no, not Carl. Someone else with a deep bass voice that was threatening, that was raging. Chris plunged down the hall and burst into the bedroom, then gasped and stood rooted in paralyzing shock as the rappings boomed massively, shivering through walls, as Carl lay unconscious on the floor near the bureau, and as Reagan, with her legs propped up and spread wide on a bed that was violently bouncing and shaking, her eyes wide and bulging with terror, and a face smeared with blood that was dripping from her nose where the nasogastric tubing had been violently ripped out, as she stared at a bone-white crucifix clutched and held poised in the air just above and aimed directly at Reagan's vagina.
Oh, please! Oh, no, please!
She was shrieking as her hands brought the crucifix closer while seeming to be straining to hold it back.
You'll do as I tell you, you filth! You'll do it!
The threatening bellow, the words came from Reagan, in a voice coarse and guttural and bristling with venom, while in an instantaneous flash, her expression and features hideously transmuted into those of the feral, demonic personality that had appeared in the course of hypnosis. And as Chris watched, stunned, both the faces and voices interchanged with rapidity.
No!
You'll do it!
No, please, no!
You will, you little bitch, or I'll kill you!
And now the switch back to Reagan, with her eyes wide and staring, as if flinching from the rush of some hideous finality, her mouth agape and shrieking until, again, the demon personality possessed her, filled her, the room suddenly filling with a stench in the nostrils, with an icy cold that seemed to seep from the walls as the rapping sounds ended and Reagan's piercing cry of terror elided into a guttural, yelping laugh of malevolent spite triumphant, while she thrust down the crucifix into her vagina. Then again and again, as she masturbated with it ferociously, while roaring in that deep, coarse, deafening voice,
"Now you're mine, you bitch, you stinking cow. Yes, let Jesus fuck you. Fuck you. Fuck you."
Chris stood rooted to the floor in horror, her hands pressing tightly against her cheeks, as again the demonic, loud laugh cackled joyously, as from Reagan's vagina her blood gushed onto white linen sheets. And then abruptly, with a shriek coming raw and clawing from her throat, Chris rushed at the bed, grasping blindly at the crucifix while her features contorting infernally. Reagan flared up at her in fury and, reaching out a hand, clutched Chris's hair and, powerfully yanking her head down, firmly pressed Chris's face against her vagina, smearing it with blood as Reagan undulated her pelvis. "Ah, little pig mother," Reagan crooned with a guttural eroticism. "Lick me, lick me, ah, lick me, ah." Then the hand that was holding Chris's head down jerked it upward, while the other arm smashed a blow across her chest that sent Chris reeling across the room and crashing to a wall with stunning force, while Reagan mockingly laughed. Chris crumpled to the floor in a daze of horror, in a swirling of images, of sounds in the room, as a vision spun, blurring, unfocused, her ears ringing loud with chaotic distortions as she weakly tried to raise herself, pushing up with her hands on the floor and faltering, looking toward the bed, toward Reagan with her back to her, thrusting the crucifix gently and sensually into her vagina, then out, then in, with that deep bass voice crooning, "Ah, there's my sow, yes, my sweet honey piglet." Chris started crawling painfully toward the bed, her face smeared with blood, her eyes still unfocused, limbs aching, and then cringed, shrinking back in incredulous terror, as she thought she saw hazily, as if in an undulating fog, her daughter's head turning slowly and inexorably, completely around on a motionless torso, until at last Chris was looking directly into the fox-like, angry eyes of Burke Dennings.
"You know what she did, your cunting daughter?"
Chris screamed until she fainted.